The Haunted UK podcast is produced and released in stereo. Listening through an environment such as headphones or stereo speakers will ensure you get the best experience. Before you decide to skip this section, don't. We usually put a podcast promo right here, but for this episode, it's going to be a little different. On the 28th of April, John McLellan is doing a kilt walk from Glasgow to Loch Lomond to raise money for the mental health charity, Mind. In 2023, John's cousin Michelle completely unexpectedly collapsed and died in the street. She'd been suffering from a series of mental health problems, which had been diagnosed when she was just 15 years old. Today, more than ever, our mental health is critically important, and we should never be afraid to speak out and ask for help. It would be amazing if you could help John raise money for this fantastic charity by getting over to Just Giving and search for Walking for Michelle. You can also find a link to the Just Giving page on John's Instagram account, which is John_McLellan_photography. Please give what you can for an amazing cause. Thank you so much. Here at Haunted UK Podcast Towers, we're committed to giving you high-quality, great episodes time after time after time. But this takes a lot of effort in research, writing, editing, recording, mixing, mastering, and publishing. We don't have a fancy production company or a bank of scriptwriters or a large budget to keep everything going. We are a fully independent podcast. If you'd like to help the show, then why not get over to Ko-fi and search for the Haunted UK podcast, where you can subscribe to give just £3 per month, the price of a coffee, or as much as you like. If you'd rather not sign up for a monthly subscription, then you can simply make a one-off donation, again, as little or as much as you like. This really helps the show with our website, coffee membership, merchandise, equipment, as well as other financial commitments. So if you feel that you'd like to help keep the lights burning, the wheels turning, and the stories rolling, then why not consider getting over to Ko-fi and donating to the show? That's Ko-fi and search for the Haunted UK podcast. Thank you. And here are the names of the amazing people who have donated to the show recently. They are Anna Kozak and, last but not least, Tracy Bowick. We also now have some exciting new merchandise available on our website, including mugs, mouse mats, drinks bottles, bags, t-shirts, hoodies, and even bottle openers. Get yourself over to www.hauntedukpodcast.com to check out our Etsy shop. Now, without any further delay, let's get this episode started. Whilst we waited for the security team and the groundskeeper, we let our control room know that we'd hit a dead end and that we would update them when someone arrived. Not more than 2 minutes later, a tall, slender gentleman dressed in navy overalls, a tan undershirt and dirty, unlaced boots slowly made his way up the stairs. Matt eagerly jumped in to introduce himself to, who seemed to be, the groundskeeper, as I updated our control room that someone had arrived to help. How wrong we were.
Thank you.
This is episode 48 of the Haunted UK podcast, and it's time to return to hear more stories from those in the emergency services and the military. As with regular listener stories episodes, the reaction to the first episode of Tales from the Emergency Services has been absolutely unbelievable. Thousands and thousands have tuned in to hear the many eerie, creepy, disturbing, and downright terrifying stories from those people who work on the front line of our emergency protection and care services. And it's not over yet. So brace yourselves as we go back into the world of potential daily danger, tragedy, and sometimes death, and listen to more of these riveting stories. As with every single person who has the courage to send in their experiences to the show, a huge, huge thank you to you all. So, let's begin with two stories which come from a nurse who we'll simply call Kay. As requested, her name and the location of her place of work have been withheld. I was a student nurse in the late 1990s. In our area, there was a very old hospital which housed mainly elderly patients as a rehab facility. The building was actually an old workhouse, which has featured on Most Haunted. It was opened on Christmas Day, I think, in 1841. Getting staff to work there was always hard. I was rotated onto nights in my second year. I was working with a woman who had worked there for over 20 years. She told me never to take a shift on the second floor ward. These were the old Nightingale wards, 12 beds in a row down each side, with a day room, sluice room, and linen store at the far end of the ward, farthest away from the nurse's station. Apparently, the old ladies used to complain every morning about the children who had been playing around the beds at night, being noisy, and even pulling their bedclothes off and dropping them on the floor. This seemed to have been worse around the beds at the far end of the ward. Staff would only go down there at night in pairs, as you could be walking and then get physically shoved from behind, often knocking people over. I was told you could feel a cold hand on your back, and you would turn around to find that no one was there, with perhaps only a lingering chill in the air. The whole building had a horrible atmosphere. Although I never took a shift on this ward, I found out years afterwards that it had been the area of the workhouse where the mothers, babies, and young children would have been housed. I've had two encounters myself when I worked nights at this hospital. On the first occasion, I'd come off my break one night to find an elderly lady standing in the day room. She looked completely real, but was wearing day clothes, like she shouldn't have been there. Kindly, I asked her to go back to her bed, as she might wake everyone up. She looked straight back at me blankly, eerily not blinking. I then casually looked down and then looked up to find that she'd vanished. In a rather rattled way, I asked my colleagues if she had gone out of the room, but they hadn't seen anyone, and all of our patients were asleep. One of my healthcare assistants once wanted to sleep on his break, so went into the day room and pulled two chairs together to make a bed. About half an hour later, he came flying out, looking absolutely terrified and grey. He said he was woken up to hands holding him down onto the chair, and he had to fight to get up.
"Get off! Get off!"
He was a very, very sensible guy who wasn't easily flustered, but he refused to ever go back into the day room again, even on days. My second encounter happened one night as I was going to the emergency drugstore which was a long way from my ward. As it was 3 a.m., there was no one on the main corridor, and I was just walking quietly as the hospital was silent. About halfway down, just before the main entrance, I saw an elderly man walking towards me. He passed me, and we nodded and smiled at each other. He was in his 70s, I would guess, slightly built in a tweed suit. I carried on, but wondered where he was going, as he was in regular clothes, so he didn't look like a patient. I finally got to the drugstore and stopped at the security desk to ask if the old guy was okay and did he need help finding where he was going. I thought he'd been called in as an emergency to visit a relative. The security guards looked at me as if I was crazy. They said nobody had come into the hospital at all. As a side note, you could only come through the main entrance as all the external doors were locked for security purposes and you were asked to sign in. I explained I'd seen an old man walking down in a kind of tweed suit with a raincoat over his arm, heading towards the B wards. I described him thoroughly, but they were adamant that nobody had come through and that neither of them had been on their break. They were 100% certain that nobody had signed in since the doors were locked at 11 p.m. We went out into the corridor, but could see no sign of the man at all. Thinking about it, he didn't seem distressed at all, which I might have expected if he had been called in to be with a dying relative. He was so real that I can still picture him. I'm sure you have lots of these kinds of sightings from emergency staff, because I know I am not the only person who has experienced things like this. I look forward to listening out for more of these stories. All the best. Kay. Our next collection of tales come from a person who is still currently serving in the British military. As you will understand, his name and any details of locations or potentially sensitive information have been taken out. We will therefore call this person Neil. He writes, "Hi Steve, here are the stories I promised to send in. I have tried to explain things as clearly as possible in non-military terms, but understand some of it may be quite confusing. During my time in the military, I have had several strange experiences that have given me a belief that there may be more stuff going on around us than we are led to believe. I would like to share two of them with you for now, as these are the two that predominantly come to mind and have stuck with me throughout the years, although there have been plenty of other times that have sadly faded from memory now and I struggle to recall, but these two I can still remember as if it were yesterday. The first one I'd like to talk about occurred around half a decade ago, in the middle of winter, whilst I was taking part in a well-known arduous promotion course on a particular training area. This course involves a lot of sleep deprivation and is extremely physical in nature. I believe it might have changed now, but it consisted of a series of week-long assessment exercises in the field, during which you were to be tested in a variety of situations to see if you are capable and ready for promotion. The weekends in between these exercises were used to help you recover. Often, due to the intensity of the course and workload, etc., many people would go the full week without any or very little sleep. It was during the first of these five-day-long excursions that I experienced something, or was part of something, that I have heard people talking about but have never thought could be possible. A mass collective hallucination. During the last night of the first week in the field, we were tasked to move by foot, at night, from one side of the training area to the other, with every piece of equipment we had. So, probably around 30 to 40 kilograms each, plus weapons, ammunition, etc. This event was known as the Zombie March, and was one of the most mind-numbing, excruciatingly boring parts of the whole course. The move was extremely slow due to the weight we carried, and as it's at night, it's done silently, which meant hours of slowly trudging across the countryside with only the barely discernible shadow of the guy in front of you to guide you, and the weight of your equipment crushing down on your shoulders. After long periods of this, the weight would start to give you a strangely claustrophobic sensation. To make matters worse, with it being the last night of the first week, none of us had slept for basically 3 nights leading up to this, and everyone was pretty fatigued by this point. Clear, logical thinking becomes extremely difficult during these times, and it's common for people to start hallucinating. It's happened to me numerous times over my career. Some of these hallucinations are so vivid that you would swear blind that whatever you're seeing is real, even while your brain is trying to tell you, for example, there can't possibly be a giant lake in front of you. You were walking on a concrete road 2 seconds ago. After maybe 4 hours of continuous walking on this particular dark, cold night, I began to suffer from these said hallucinations once again. It was the first time I'd had any that week, and they began to occur as we were patrolling through a forestry block which had a gravel road running through the center of it. Whilst watching out into the trees through my night vision device, I began to see movement. On a second look, I saw, clear as day, that the trees behind the nearest row of trees to myself had transformed themselves into large high-rise buildings, like skyscrapers. Vividly, I began to see that I was now in some kind of city or town, with cars driving up and down behind the trees, shadowy figures of people peering out of windows and walking up and down. I even remembered being able to see things like streetlights, post boxes, intricate details of the buildings. Now, this was easily one of, if not the most intense hallucination I've ever had, and still is to this day, but luckily, I was almost immediately aware that what I was seeing wasn't real. This was mostly due to the fact that I was very familiar with the training area we were on at the time, and I knew full well that there were no towns or cities anywhere near us, especially ones consisting of skyscrapers. Also, having experienced hallucinations before, I was able to identify that I was more than likely having one of these episodes again, and that all these lights and shapes were probably being caused by moonlight and stars flickering through the canopy of the trees around me. Despite this knowledge, and continually reassuring myself of this fact whilst focusing on just following the guy in front of me, my eyes refused to believe what my brain was telling it, and the hallucinations continued for what felt like about 15 to 20 minutes. I actually started to find it quite amusing by the end of it, until we'd exited the forest on the far side and were back under open skies. I thought nothing else of this once we were out of the trees and just got back to trying not to collapse with exhaustion and get to the end of the march. When we did get there, however, something really strange began to happen. We were taken into an admin area next to an old farm and told to cache our heavy backpacks known as Bergens and then wait for the next phase of the course to start, which was an attack onto an objective at first light. After dropping my Bergen off, I looked around at the rest of the platoon and noticed groups of people frantically gathered around maps and pulling out GPSs and compasses. GPSs were not allowed on this course, but a few people had smuggled them out. Some people were even getting out torches, and I could tell some kind of confusion was setting in. I went over to the people closest to me and asked what was going on, and was immediately told that we must have got lost during the march. We weren't supposed to have gone through a town on the way, so either the grid was wrong, or we'd gone the wrong way getting there. At first, I found this funny. I realized that most of the other students on the course, being based all across the UK, did not know the training area as well as me, so must have had the same hallucination as I did and thought it was a real town. Suddenly, it then dawned on me. If that was true, then everyone had experienced the same hallucination in exactly the same place, which completely blew my mind and was something I'd never heard of before. I began questioning people about what they'd seen, and from what I could gather, they had all seen exactly the same thing as me, giving details about the cars and streetlights, etc., and how they'd seen people walking around as well. I suddenly had to question everything I thought I knew at that point and started having a moment of existential crisis. I began checking my own map, even though I knew for a fact it would have been literally impossible for us to have passed through any form of civilization and still be in the right place now. Even if we had taken that big of a detour to reach some place that was not on any of our maps, we would never have made it to where we were now in the required time. I tried to explain this to other people, but was having trouble getting through to them. Luckily, however, there were other people on the course who knew the training area or were able to recognize that it was a hallucination, etc., who were also doing their best to explain to people. Eventually, logic began to re-establish itself. There were other clues that proved we were in the right place, such as the directing staff, people who run the course, showing up and not kicking off at us for being in the wrong place, as well as everyone with GPS confirming that we were at the right grid. After this, we launched into the final attack, and then we had a weekend to recuperate before the next week began. So this event was quickly forgotten about. People have tried to explain to me that this happens all the time and that there is a scientific explanation behind it, but I still can't get my head around the fact that upwards of 50 people with no communication with each other can all have the same vision at separate times whilst passing through the same location, like some kind of internal Bluetooth passing on the hallucination to the next guy behind. How can this be normal? This second experience I wanted to share could also involve an hallucination. However, I am almost entirely convinced that what I saw does not fall into that category. I felt that it was something different and tangible. The reasons for this are because when this event occurred, I was by no means tired enough or in the right frame of mind or state of exhaustion that is normally required for those types of things to be experienced. In fact, I was quite alert and well rested at the time. However, this is all I've got to go on due to the lack of physical evidence. This incident took place whilst on tour as a young private soldier, all the way on the other side of the world in Helmand, Afghanistan. I won't say what year it was, but it was quite a hard fighting tour in the summer when the conflict was in full swing. The main threat at the time was IEDs, improvised explosive devices, but with it being summer, there was plenty of vegetation around for enemy fighters to move about in, meaning you had to be on constant alert for enemy contact as well. I was posted to a small CP, which again, I won't go into too much detail about, but basically, a CP was an outpost occupied by a platoon of about 20 to 30 guys. There were loads of these dotted across the countryside, usually along main transit routes and road junctions around the province, to try to dominate the ground and disrupt Taliban fighters' movements. The CP I was in consisted of an inner compound with a large guard tower or super sangha in the middle, providing good observation in a 360-degree radius of the CP. An outer courtyard, which wasn't as secure as the inner compound, was ringed by an 8 to 10-foot wall, thick enough to stop enemy fire. This was topped with multiple rows of razor wire and a few more guard positions in various places, so still pretty well defended. Outside, this was a maze of trip flares, low wire entanglements, and last but not least, Claymore mines. For any living thing to get in or out undetected would be pretty difficult. One night, about halfway through the tour, I was on guard duty in the Super Sangha, watching over the CP whilst the rest of the platoon slept. The way the guard shifts worked was that you would do a 3-hour rotation between three different positions, manning the Super Sangha for 1 hour, then after you got relieved by the next guy coming on rotation, you would go down to one of the guard positions in the outer courtyard for an hour, before moving on to roaming sentry for your final hour. The roaming sentry's job was to wander around inside the CP, mainly in the outer courtyard, checking any blind spots and keeping radio communication between the two guard positions, making sure no one had fallen asleep on sentry duty, etc. Once you finished your hour of roaming sentry, you would then go and wake up the next guy whose turn it was to man the Super Sangha, making sure all the positions got rotated correctly before you could then go to bed. This could be a bit of a slog if you went on at, say, 3 in the morning and then had to go on patrol, etc. But that's just the way it was, and everyone just got on with it. The reason you started on the Super Sangha was because this was deemed to be the most important of all the positions in the CP. Therefore, it was better to go up there for the first hour of your shift, because in theory, you would be the most alert during this hour. By the time you got to the roaming sentry shift, you would probably be pretty tired, bored, and fed up, but it wasn't as important, because all you had to do was walk around and didn't have to worry about spotting enemy fighters sneaking up on the base, etc. On this particular night, I remember the sky was a moonless night but clear, so I still had a good bit of visibility through the night vision devices, or NVD, infrared imaging devices, IIs, and the thermal imagery, TI optics in the Sangha, which is what I was using to scan the countryside outside the CP, searching for potential threats. I had been observing like this for probably around half an hour when something caught my eye. I was scanning from right to left with the infrared optic when suddenly I spotted something moving unnaturally right at the bottom of the field of view. Quickly, I moved the sight down so that the object was in the center of the field of view, and to my surprise, found myself looking down into the outer courtyard of the CP. I also found myself looking at what appeared to be a large black dog-like creature, with its body low to the ground, slowly stalking across the courtyard in the direction of the entrance to the inner compound. There were a lot of large stray dogs in the area, and I immediately assumed it to be one of these that had somehow got into the CP and was about to start shouting to try and alert the roaming sentry to scare it off, when suddenly I heard the noise of someone opening the door at the entrance between the inner and outer compound, the same one that the dog was moving towards. The roaming sentry was about to walk out into the outer courtyard, and it looked like the dog had his scent and was lurking there just waiting for him to open the door. Knowing that the guy on roaming sentry was probably half asleep, that I might not have time to stop him going through the doors, and thinking that he was about to get attacked in the pitch black by a huge potentially rabid dog, I decided I was going to have to take action. I grabbed a rocket illume, which is a hand-fired rocket flare used to light up large areas for long periods of time, like a flare gun you see on ships, but these are tube-shaped, with a twist cap at the bottom to fire them. They make a very loud noise when fired, and the rocket shoots up into the air. They then make a loud bang as the flare ignites, which sounds like a gunshot, and then they hang in the air on a parachute for around a minute to 30 seconds. I've never seen an animal that doesn't get scared off when you fire one of these, except Brecon sheep, but they don't count. and I knew shouting may not have an effect, so I quickly pointed the rocket high in the air, directly over where I had last seen the dog, and fired it into the night sky. Three things happened when I did this. Firstly, the guy on roaming sentry absolutely had a near heart attack and jumped back from the door as I'd hoped. Secondly, the dog, or whatever the animal was, had fled by the time the flare was fully lit, which is a delay of around 1 to 2 seconds. The creature had vanished, but in the dull light as it started to burn, I distinctly remember seeing a large black shape fleeing towards one of the corners of the outer courtyard. The dog was never seen again. The third thing to come out of this was about 15 to 20 minutes later, when I was rotated off the Super Sangha. On climbing down from the tower, I was greeted by my section commander, who to my surprise, was not best pleased. It turned out that the rocket had also woken up half the people in the CP. Afterwards, I explained to the guy on roaming sentry why I'd fired it, thinking he would have been overjoyed with me saving him from the dog. But what actually happened was that he thought I'd made the whole thing up, just as an excuse to either scare him or fire the rocket illume. He had then gone and told these theories to my corporal. I tried to explain that I'd seen a large dog in the CP and why I'd fired it. My corporal was unmoved, however, and simply told me that there was no possible way a dog could have got into the CP. We went back and forth for a bit. My main reason for thinking it made sense was that when he had first established the CP, I remembered that there was a crumbled down bit of wall in the corner of the courtyard that I had seen the dog run back towards, and I told him the dog had probably got out through the small hole where it was. Again, all he said was that it was impossible and told me to go and look at the corner of the wall. I made my way over to it and discovered that whilst I had been on patrol a few days before, the platoon sergeant had assigned a work party to repair the small hole in the wall, which they'd plugged with sandbags, razor wire, and steel bars. On seeing that, I had to admit that there was no way anything could have got through there. I could also find no other evidence in the CP, such as paw marks in the dust, etc. The next day, I had to explain myself to the platoon sergeant. I stuck to my guns and told them exactly what I saw, and I could tell he just didn't believe me. Luckily for me, my section commander offered the theory that I must have seen something outside the CP and confused it for something inside. This saved me from too bad of a punishment, but I still ended up having to fill sandbags for a few hours. I appreciated my section commander stepping in, but I don't believe his explanation to be true. Outside the CP in that direction was mostly trees and buildings, and very little open ground. So the only place I would have been able to make something out in an open area of open ground would have been inside the CP. I've still got no idea what I saw that night, but I still remember it clearly, and there was definitely something there. As you'd expect, I got a bit of banter about it for the next couple of weeks, so I tried not to bring it up. But I still wonder about it to this day. Neil also has a fantastic Instagram account, which he uses to tell amazing real stories of UFO and paranormal encounters. These stories focus mainly on the British Army, Navy, and Air Force, and the information is both fascinating and thought-provoking. I really recommend that you follow his account and support the brilliant content that he puts out there. You can find him on Instagram at Ghoul of the Empire. Our next story was kindly sent in by a former female police officer who, whilst attending a call at a large house because of an alarm going off, saw something extremely creepy. What makes this story so compelling is that she wasn't alone. Her colleague also experienced it. Again, as requested by the listener, all names and locations have either been changed or left out. This is her story. Once upon a time, I was a police officer in a rural town in East Anglia. There were some very beautiful big houses that came with the money of living in the area. There was one in particular that caught my eye. It was a grand 1800s three-story, seven-bedroom gated mansion with a beautiful fountain in the drive, set in amongst sparse trees. The owners of the house intended to sell the property. They picked up most of their belongings and left the area while the groundskeeper stayed and made sure that the house was presentable for potential buyers. Our inspector told us that the windows and doors were all individually alarmed. It seemed they'd spared no expense on security with cameras and alarms. It was a patchy, cloudy, mild November night shift in 2018. Myself and my colleague Matt, not his real name, were called to this house after a window alarm had started to sound, which alerted the security company, who in turn called the police. We were told a spare key for the property was located in a lockbox, and we were given the code which would allow us to get into the property. We approached the house, and the gates creaked and edged their way open. We then drove into the driveway to the left, around the grand fountain. We found the lockbox, got the key, and looked around the outside of the house with our torches to see if there was anything obvious to have caused the alarm to sound. The security company could see us on their monitors and confirmed that they'd alerted the groundskeeper that we were there. Their own security team and the groundskeeper would be there in approximately 45 minutes to reset the alarms and help us out with the situation. We let ourselves in via the huge double doors at the front of the house. The inside of the house was cold from the moment I walked through the door. It was like I'd walked into a wall of cold when compared to the mild air outside. A large kitchen was situated to the left-hand side of the house, and it was a shaker-style kitchen with an island in the middle and a butler's sink. To the right, as you walked into the house, there was a dining room with a stage piano and a table to seat at least 12 people. At the end of the dining room, there was a living room with a TV, a corner sofa, and French doors that led out to the spaciousness of the back garden. This seemed endless in the pitch black with its rows of trees. There was a marble staircase ahead of me, which came to a landing and branched both left and right, allowing access to the first floor and five of the seven bedrooms. It was like a Hollywood movie set in there, as tall, narrow windows beamed in the moonlight at the top of the stairs, which allowed us to make out the light switch and turn on the lights to see the biggest crystal chandelier I'd ever seen in my life. They provided a dim light, but bright enough to see the house in all of its glory. Methodically, we searched the downstairs of the house, expecting to find the local children taking advantage of this vacant mansion. We met up again at the bottom of the stairs and slowly began to work our way up to the landing area. I went to the left and Matt went to the right. We searched the bedrooms one by one. Each bedroom housed a beautiful four-poster bed, period antique wardrobes and dressers. We searched both bathrooms with beautiful roll-top baths and checkered floor tiles. We approached the second-floor stairway where Matt, very gentlemanly, went up the not-so-elegant wooden stairway, which led to a locked small door, which we assumed led to the final two bedrooms and a final bathroom. As it was locked, we decided to wait until the groundskeeper could let us up there. We could then check those final rooms and give the house the all clear. Whilst we waited for the security team and the groundskeeper, we let our control room know that we'd hit a dead end and that we would update them when someone arrived. Not more than 2 minutes later, a tall, slender gentleman dressed in navy overalls, a tan undershirt and dirty unlaced boots slowly made his way up the stairs. Matt eagerly jumped in to introduce himself to, who seemed to be, the groundskeeper, as I updated our control room that someone had arrived to help. How wrong we were. The gentleman completely ignored Matt's polite introduction and his request to open the little door at the top of the stairs. He walked up to the smaller stairway, straight up the stairs, stopped, slowly turned his head, and looked directly at us. And then walked straight through the closed door and vanished like he was never there. The house was cold anyway, but my blood froze so much that there was a lump in my throat, and it made me want to vomit. I felt tied to the spot, helpless, vulnerable. There was a 10-second or so silence, which felt like hours. Matt slowly looked around at me, and suddenly our bodies sprung to life. We both ran as fast as our legs would carry us down the marble stairs, but the beautiful dated mats on the stairs slid and knocked us both off balance. I tripped on the stairs at the front of the house as my legs gave way from fear. Matt fumbled for the car keys that he had hooked onto the clip on his belt, but as my legs had stopped working, so did his hands.
For God's sake!
I was in tears at this point, begging and crying for Matt to unlock the car doors. As soon as the indicators blinked and the door clicked, I swung the door so hard it bounced back on its hinges. I slumped into the car and screamed for Matt to drive.
Drive!
We swung around the fountain and waited at the gates, which only seemed to open slower the more we cried out and panicked.
Please open!
We were met by the security company at the end of the road, and we explained what we'd witnessed. The groundskeeper appeared 10 minutes later to tell us that we had more than likely met Mo, who sadly passed away in the house after a tragic accident while tending to the looming trees in the garden around 10 years ago. We got back to our station and explained to the inspector what had happened and why I was crying so hard that my mascara had run, making me look like Alice Cooper. We were shaking uncontrollably and were sent home immediately. Our inspector explained that he believed us, and it wasn't this station's first encounter with Mo, who had apparently made himself known at the property when our inspector was a probationary police officer some years earlier. We explained that we hoped just to find some kids messing around at the house, and we could take them home to their parents. Our inspector corrected us, saying that kids didn't go there anymore. They were too scared of Mo. I was also lucky enough to spend Halloween in the grounds of Borley Rectory in this job. The rectory is only 30 minutes from my house. That could be another story for another day. I absolutely love the show. Please keep up all the good work you do, keeping me company on my journey to and from work. Our next story was sent in by Tim, and although it's a short story, it's absolutely fascinating. It also just goes to show that it's not only people that can move on to the spirit world. About 15 years ago, I was working for a police force in the control room, and because I lived a long distance from my work, I was renting force accommodation on site near the control room during my shifts. The accommodation was a room within a block of similar rooms, all within an old barracks, which were often used to house officers on training courses. I never felt uncomfortable in the accommodation, despite the remote setting within a country park and the odd sounds I would hear at night on a regular basis. On the day in question, I was working a night shift and arrived at the accommodation block at about 3 p.m. and could see that, as usual, I would have it to myself, as there were no other cars present. I unloaded my gear from the car and entered the block via a door that was adjacent to my room. As I walked in, I saw something move out of the corner of my eye and looked down to the floor to my right and saw a cat about 8 feet away from me. I'd clearly startled the poor animal as it turned and glared at me and hunkered down close to the floor before darting away down the corridor. As it ran, I stared in disbelief as it just dissolved into thin air right in front of me over the course of a couple of seconds. The corridor linked all the private rooms with a shower room at each end and a kitchen in the middle. I checked all of the doors, which were closed, and the windows along the corridor were all secure. There was literally nowhere that that cat could have gone. That night, I started my shift and made the mistake of telling a colleague what happened. Before midnight, the entire shift knew, and it took weeks before they'd let it drop. I never witnessed anything else within the accommodation, but always kept an eye out for the cat, hoping to see it again. Thanks for your interest in this, Steve, and just want to say that I'm really enjoying the podcast. Keep up the brilliant work. Cheers, Tim. We now move on to a collection of stories sent in by Rebecca. Carers in our communities do an incredible job, and each person's circumstances who they attend to can be wildly different from the last. As with the police, nurses, doctors, firefighters and the military, our carers take on many jobs, which the majority of us probably feel we simply couldn't do. These are Rebecca's stories. I've always believed in the paranormal, but didn't think anything would happen to me. I'm going to tell you a few experiences I've had from working in care. For obvious reasons, I've changed the names of the people I cared for. I lived in a town in the East Midlands. It was early 2011. I was 20 years old when I decided on a career change after working in customer services for 4 years. I excitedly started my new career in care. My first unexplained experience happened within a few months of starting my new job. After getting comfortable working with another carer on the double run, I was asked to work some of the single runs where I would work alone. I would then frequently do this when the regular carer for that run was off ill, on her day off, or was on holiday. I used to visit a lady who lived near the old airfield at the top of the town. We would enter her semi-detached bungalow via the rear entrance with a safe key, which led into the kitchen. The bungalow didn't have a front door, but had a side door, which was very rarely used. As you entered the kitchen, there was one corridor leading from it, with all the other rooms branching off this corridor. On the left of the corridor was the lounge diner and the master bedroom. On the right was the bathroom and side door. And at the very end, opposite the kitchen, was the second bedroom where we would dry the washing and where we kept the ladies' incontinence wear in large boxes. The lady, let's call her Jane, had dementia, was hard of hearing, and had some other ailments making it difficult for her to get around. I'd been in that morning and helped Jane out of bed, assisted her with washing, etc., and made her breakfast. I left her as usual in the armchair in the corner of the lounge. I went back at lunchtime and asked her what she'd like to eat, made her a cup of tea, and while her lunch was in the microwave, I busied myself making her sandwiches and nibbles for tea time. I covered all of this for later and put it in the fridge. Her lunch was ready, and while I was in the lounge with Jane, writing my notes, and as Jane ate her lunch, I could hear what sounded like things moving around in the kitchen. Thinking I just had a busy morning and was just tired, I then heard what sounded like a glass tumbler being knocked over. Instantly, I thought there was someone in the kitchen, so I got up and rushed in to see who it was. And to my surprise, there was no one there. And everything was how I'd left it. I started tidying away and looked for a glass tumbler on its side. I'd checked in all the cupboards and even checked the fridge, but I couldn't find anything out of place. I thought I was going mad. But it was the next thing that happened at Jane's which was the most terrifying. Around a month after this first experience, I was on the single run again, but this time on the tea and bed shift. I arrived at Jane's to assist her into bed at around 7:30 p.m. It was July-August time, so it was still very light outside. I entered the bungalow, flicked the kettle on, and went into the lounge where she was sitting in the armchair. I asked if she was okay and what she'd done through the day. Just the usual chit-chat. I closed the curtains in the lounge and walked back across the lounge to flick the light on, the whole time talking to Jane. As I turned on the light and turned around in her direction, I froze in fear and my heart felt like it was pounding out of my chest. Because above her was a black ball-shaped shadow floating above her head. I couldn't talk, couldn't move or even breathe, and I have no idea how long it was there. It could have been seconds or minutes. It wasn't moving around, but seemed to be moving in on itself. Then it shot across the room and went through the wall. I don't remember much else about that evening, other than bolting for the door as soon as Jane was in bed. I didn't want to mention anything to the other members of staff as I was the newest and youngest member on the team and didn't want anyone thinking I was strange, so I kept my mouth shut. The third and final time something happened to me while I was at Jane's was around October time. I remember it being a tea time call and it had just started to get dark outside. As usual, I went through the kitchen and checked to see if Jane was okay. As I came back out of the lounge, I could hear what sounded like a box being dragged in the second bedroom at the end of the corridor. I put the kettle on and went back to see if I could still hear anything. I placed my ear to the door and could distinctly hear the unmistakable sound of the heavy incontinence ware boxes being dragged, and it sounded like they were being dragged behind the door. I thought for certain I wouldn't be able to open the door because a box would be in the way, but I took a deep breath and flung the door open. To my surprise, the boxes hadn't moved at all. They were still in the corner of the room where they'd been left a few days previously when they had been delivered. You would always get this awful, odd feeling in that bungalow of being watched, whatever time of the day you were there. It also seemed unusually cold in there, even in the middle of summer. It wasn't until a month or so after this happened that we had a new carer start working with us. She happened to say she hated going to Jane's because of how it felt. I then opened up and told her about my experiences in the bungalow. Coyly, she looked at me and said she wasn't surprised because it felt awful in there and she didn't quite understand how Jane managed to live there for so long. Soon after, Jane was taken from her home and put into a care home as her bungalow had been burgled, and the family understandably needed to know she was safe. While I missed seeing her, I didn't miss visiting the bungalow, and I often wondered if the bungalow was haunted, or if she was. So for my next story, we visited a lady also on the single run called Hilda. Hilda had glaucoma and was in the beginning stages of dementia. We would only visit Hilda twice a day. She lived in a Victorian end of terrace three-bedroom house near the centre of town. It was a beautiful house that had two reception rooms, kitchen, and downstairs bathroom. Upstairs had a big master bedroom at the front, a double middle bedroom, and then an L-shaped corridor which had the bathroom in the middle and another smaller bedroom at the end. This bedroom was always kept shut, and I believe her family used it for storage, as it had a lock. As Hilda had glaucoma, her eyesight was very poor, so she kept herself to the downstairs back reception room and the upstairs middle bedroom, which had a commode in it, so she didn't have to try and find the bathroom in the middle of the night. I remember it being summer when I was on the evening single run, and then I also would be on the same run the following morning. I visited Hilda at around 6 p.m. that evening, going through the alleyway between hers and her neighbour's house to gain entry into the kitchen using the key safe. As I went in, it sounded as though she was having a conversation with someone, so I said hello and asked how she was and if she had company. She looked at me confused and asked who I was, as she just let another carer in. It started to ring alarm bells as I was the only carer scheduled to visit her that evening, and as her eyesight was poor, I thought maybe she'd let someone in wearing the same colour uniform as ours, posing as one of us. I explained I was from the company and told her it was me, giving her my name, explaining I'd been in a few days prior, reminding her of the pets I had, so she knew it was me. I asked her where the other carer was and if she remembered their name, the whole time having 999 ready to dial on my phone whilst trying to remain calm. She said the other lady came in and took her washing into the front room and was putting it on the radiators, but she didn't know her name. I went into the front room, but there was no one there. The washing had been placed on an armchair and the front door was still locked. I said maybe they had gone upstairs, so I ran upstairs and checked all the rooms, looked in wardrobes and under beds, etc. The only room I couldn't check was the back bedroom, as it was locked and the family had the only key, but they lived in a different county and had recently visited, so I found this very strange. I went back downstairs and explained that the other carer must have gone, just putting it down to her poor vision, the onset of dementia. I helped Hilda into her pajamas, made sure she had her medication, and made her something to eat and drink. While she did this, I asked if it was okay to complete my tasks upstairs, which consisted of turning her bed covers over and removing the lid from the commode. Before I went upstairs, she asked me to tell the children to be quiet as they'd been giving her a headache. I played along and said of course I would. I was only upstairs a few minutes, and when I came back down, I told her the children had left, and maybe it was the kids next door, as it was the school holidays. I left her that evening safe and went about the rest of my shift. The next day, I arrived back at Hilda's in the late morning, and she was already up, had eaten her breakfast, washed, and dressed. I asked her if she was okay and if she'd slept well. She said she did, apart from the children waking her in the middle of the night. I made her a hot drink, made sure she took her meds, then went upstairs to make her bed and empty the commode. I remember it being cold upstairs, despite it being almost lunchtime in summer, and I even had a shiver run down my spine, which was unusual. I went into her bedroom, made the bed, took the bucket from the commode, and went in the direction of the upstairs bathroom where I'd been many times before. However, this time, I just couldn't do it. I had an awful feeling that I was being watched. I remember getting my phone out of my pocket and turning it to selfie mode to check round the corner into the corridor so I didn't have to look myself. And it was then that I was completely and utterly horrified. The locked door at the end of the corridor was wide open. Drawers, boxes, and wardrobes were all open, with clothes, shoes, bedding, etc. flung all around the room. I doubt that her family had left it in this way, as the rest of the house was immaculate, and although Hilda's vision wasn't good, she was still house-proud. It's safe to say that I certainly wasn't feeling brave that day, and even considered leaving the commode for the next carer to turn up later that evening, but that wouldn't have been fair. So I made the trip downstairs to the bathroom down there, emptied and cleaned the bucket, and went back upstairs. I checked again down the corridor with my phone, and I froze to the spot, because that door at the end of the corridor was now shut. In a panic, I ran back downstairs, finished my call with Hilda, and made for the door. I never had another experience like that, or ever felt that feeling in her house again. Maybe she'd let something in when she opened the door the previous day. I did, however, mention it to my then manager, and she contacted the family, but I never knew what or if anything came of it. The most heartbreaking experience I've had was on the double run with another carer that I worked with often. We went to a lady called Margaret, and she had dementia, but still had her wits about her, and she'd regularly have us in fits of laughter. We also got to know the family very well, as they only lived a few streets away, and would visit doing odd jobs, buying food, and cleaning almost every day. Margaret's daughter-in-law pulled us to one side one day, and with tears in her eyes explained her son had been diagnosed with terminal cancer, and didn't have long left to live. This was kept out of earshot of Margaret, as she was easily distressed, and for obvious reasons, the family wanted to keep this from her. Her daughter-in-law was incredibly upset. She was about to lose her son, and his daughter was about to lose her dad. We were all so upset for the family, but did our best not to say anything to Margaret. So, we carried on as normal, and would always be supportive to the family when we saw them, and kept their wishes of nothing being mentioned to Margaret. Around 6 weeks later, we arrived as normal on a Friday morning, and Margaret was upset. We asked if she'd had a bad dream, as this was very unusual for her, but she said a beautiful boy had visited her that evening and said he loved her. She kept saying how beautiful this little boy was who visited her, and she loved him, and he loved her. It was really out of character for her, but not unusual for her to mistake a dream for real life. So we cheered her up, sang Elvis's songs, as they were her favorite, and gave her lots of reassuring cuddles. We just settled Margaret into her chair when her son came through the door with some bread. We were trying to show him that the hoist was getting stuck on some wires and asked if he could do something to help when he had time. He said he would, and asked if he could talk with us in the kitchen. We all went to the kitchen, and that's when he told us his son had passed the previous evening. We were all so upset and told him that if there was anything that we could do to leave us a note or call us, we would save them the trouble of telling the whole team, and he asked that we kept this from his mum. When we left that call, I remember sitting in my car and having a good cry. Then I remembered what Margaret said and asked the other carer if she thought that he'd visited his grandmother in spirit or in her dream and showed himself in a way she would remember him, or just a time when he was happy. We both believe that's exactly what it was, and it brings me comfort that he may have also been waiting for her when she passed a few years later. I get so much satisfaction from my job and have cared for so many people over the past 13 years. It brings me joy and peace to think that when my time is over in this world, I might be reunited with some of the lovely people I've cared for in the next world. I've had other experiences outside of work, and I believe we have a guardian angel. Maybe I'll share those experiences with you another time. I do hope you've enjoyed reading my stories, and whether they end up in the podcast or not, it's nice to share with people who like to listen. Please keep doing the podcast. My son and I listen religiously, and it'd be great to hear my paranormal story on your show. Kind regards, Rebecca. Our last set of tales comes from Victoria, and she describes a number of very eerie and creepy incidents which she's experienced during her time working within the NHS. For me, hospitals can be a strange and confusing place at the best of times, with their seemingly miles of endless corridors and hundreds of rooms. But during the night, when these huge maze-like buildings are much quieter, they can take on a much more forbidding aspect and atmosphere. About 12 years ago, I was a medical student in the south of England, and my placement at that time was on a ward for patients of various ages. There were three bays with several beds in each one, and a long corridor with five or six individual patient rooms. Opposite these rooms were the treatment room and staff room, so you found yourself frequently up and down that corridor all day. It was a fairly new building, only about 5 years old at the time, so not stereotypically spooky by any means. But I absolutely hated one of the patient side rooms. As soon as I'd step into that room to see a patient, I felt like someone was standing right behind me, and I'd feel panicked, as if I couldn't breathe. On a night shift, the room had been deep cleaned that day, so the cleaners had propped the door to the room open. Every time I walked past that room, I felt as if a tall figure stepped out behind me and started to follow me. It bothered me to the extent that I went back and closed the door to the room. One of the ward staff asked me why I'd done that, so I told her. She said that a few years earlier, a young man had died in that room. He'd had a medical emergency, felt unwell, and pressed the call bell. But in his urgency, he stumbled out of bed and fell against the door, which meant the staff couldn't get into the room in time to help him. He died on the floor of that room. She said since then, patients frequently asked to be moved from that room, saying that they felt either watched or very uncomfortable, or that they had woken up to find a man standing beside the bed, just looking at them with a desperate look in his eyes. None of the staff would apparently use that room for breaks during night shifts. I never saw anything there, but I could certainly feel a very distinct presence in that room. In another incident, I was on an elderly care ward, again on a night shift. I was sitting at the nurse's station alone, reading over my revision notes, while the other nurses were in the treatment room. All the patients were asleep, and it was around 2 a.m., and the ward was absolutely silent. I suddenly heard a female voice from the entrance to the woman's bay say,
"Excuse me."
I turned to see an old lady standing there, in a white nightdress with pink flowers on it. I put my book down, but when I glanced back at her, she was gone. I walked all around the female bays, and all of the patients were asleep, and not one of them was wearing that nightdress. I even searched the male bays and corridors, but she was gone. There was no exit other than walking past the nurse's station, so if she'd wandered onto the ward from somewhere else, or wandered off the ward, she'd have to have walked past me. I never saw her again after that night. For my final story, I was working on an oncology unit, and there was a patient in one of the side rooms who was sadly reaching the final few days of their life. They didn't have visitors during the day, only usually in the evening, so they were alone most of the daytime. I was going to review them on a ward round, but I thought if they were asleep, I wouldn't disturb them, and I'd have a chat with their nurse instead. I peered through the window in their door before I went into the room, and I was quite surprised to see an old man sitting in the chair beside the bed. He was quite elderly, dressed in a brown tweed suit. I wondered if he'd have any questions for the medical team, so I knocked on the door and then opened it and stepped into the room. I was absolutely stunned to see the chair was empty. There was absolutely no one in the room other than me and the patient. I hadn't even contemplated that he wasn't a living, breathing person. He was completely solid. I like to think that it was a deceased loved one, watching over the patient when their living family members couldn't be there for them. Or perhaps he was waiting to take them to the other side. The patient sadly passed away a couple of days later. I think you'll all agree that these two special episodes have not only been creepy and eerie, but also fascinating and amazing. I want to give a huge personal thanks to every single person who has sent in their stories. Thank you so much for trusting the show, and I really hope that we've done your stories justice. So, until then, whatever profession you are currently in, keep your wits about you. Look about your workspace. For instance, look up at that flickering light in the office. Look sideways at the door that always creaks itself open. And don't look, whatever you do. Just don't look at that old cracked mirror in those toilets at the end of that creaky corridor. Because you have this ever so strange feeling that if you do, you might see something. A silhouette, perhaps of something not of this world, standing right behind you, with a grimace on its half-hidden face. And you know then that the next person to feature on an episode could be you. Do you have an interesting story which you'd be willing to share with the show? If so, your story could feature in our end-of-season Listener Stories episodes. Please get in touch with the show via email at contactus@hauntedukpodcast.com, marking the subject as Listener Story. We're waiting for your stories. As well as coffee, you can also follow the Haunted UK podcast on Twitter at Haunted UK Pod and on Instagram at Haunted UK Podcast. You can also find us on our website at www.hauntedukpodcast.com, where you'll be able to keep up to date with news and announcements, browse and download our episode scripts, get in touch with us, and much, much more. This episode was presented by Steve, produced by Pink Flamingo Home Studio, which you can also find on Instagram by searching for at Pink Flamingo Home Studio. The script for this episode was edited by Marie Waller Proofreading. For more information about this service, contact Marie at mariewaller.proofreading@gmail.com. For a list of all research sources which we found helpful for the writing of this episode, please see the show's notes. Thank you again for listening to and supporting the Haunted UK podcast. So until the next episode, stay safe and take care.